In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Tribal law enforcement officers train closer to home. Lee Strubinger has the story. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, July 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an update on efforts to coordinate policing across state and tribal jurisdiction. Then South Dakotans impacted by flooding have questions about what kind of relief might be available in the days ahead. We talk with an emergency management official from Union County. Teacher Talk explores a landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling that addressed prayer in schools. We'll ask what today's teachers need to know about faith in the classroom. Plus, new music for the middle of the year with David Hirsrud and a song from Eliza Blue later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Attorney General's Office is offering its first basic law enforcement course involving tribal law enforcement. Officials hope the statewide basic training, which is held in Pierre, will become a regional training for Native American officers. SDPB's Lee Strubinger joins us now from our Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City with an update. Lee, thanks for being here.
Hey.
Some of the background. Why is Attorney General Marty Jackley hoping that the Mickelson Justice Center in Pierre can become this regional training center for tribal cops?
Yeah, so the short answer is time and distance. Upcoming tribal officers typically complete their training and get Bureau of Indian Affairs certified down in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the basic training course is about 13 weeks long. That's a really long time to be away from home, and that's something tribal, congressional, and state officials have all talked about as being a barrier to getting more recruits to join the force. And even yesterday, we heard from three Native American trainees who are in the middle of the 13-week course now, and they all said that being in Pierre allows them to go home on the weekends and to be with their families and community. Attorney General Marty Jackley says the overall goal is to offer similar state law enforcement training with the BIA component that's taught in New Mexico.
And why that makes sense for the South Dakota is, number one, it will give us more efficient and effective training. It'll give us more resources, including federal resources. And I think those are good things, especially as we continue to move forward. So it's essentially the same training. The BIA Special Law Enforcement Commission training will be the same, and it will be the same test.
So that Special Enforcement Commission training component, that's required for the tribal officers going through the course right now. Mm-hmm. And of the 24 officers who are in training in Pierre right now, 11 could graduate. 11 are Native American officers and can graduate and go for that certification.
All right. So is this the first time that tribal officers have attended this this training?
This is not the first time, but this is the first course since Governor Kristi Noem put a priority on offering a class dedicated to tribal officers. She asked Attorney General Jackley to do it. And so the state portion of the training is remaining the same. It's split into three different phases, the first one being non-emergency, the next one being emergency, and then the last one being uniform. They're in the middle of the second component right now. And Jackley says that the uniform training, both for Native and non-Native officers across jurisdictions in South Dakota, is important. That way that each officer will know what other officers from different departments are doing. And he says that will also help build relationships between those departments. Once the 13-week course is finished and officers are state certified, then the U.S. Attorney's Office, in partnership with the Department of Justice, will offer the Indian country law side of things. Mm-hmm. And that's what's called, you heard Jackley say it, the Special Law Enforcement Commission certification, or SLEC. And it will get offered once the regular 13-week course is finished. U.S. Attorney Allison Ramsdell says the intention is to get officer training in South Dakota so that the Department of Justice can help administer it.
And in that case, you'll see a lot of folks from our office teach on the requirements of an SLEC. And so that's still in process, but is also our intention to contribute to that effort.
I want to ask you about what this certification allows them to do, but let's go back for a minute, Lee, because I think either I misheard you or you misspoke, but the training is split into three different phases. What are those phases again?
Yeah, so they're non-emergency, emergency, and investigation. So the non-emergency would be sort of how traffic stops kind of look and those sorts of things. Emergency would be if you're sort of maybe in conflict with a certain suspect. Mm-hmm. And then I'm being very general here. And then sure. Investigation, I think, kind of speaks for itself.
Right.
So they kind of build upon each other as they go across the training.
Yeah. So let's talk about that certification, that Special Law Enforcement Commission or SLEC. What does that allow an officer to do?
Yeah, so again, that's the BIA certification, and Attorney General Jackley says it basically gives an officer the ability to make a federal arrest in Indian country. And again, that component of it is typically offered in New Mexico, and Jackley says that course will happen in South Dakota this year, and that's part of what is new this year. But the BIA will ultimately have to approve and issue those cards and those certifications.
So we hear this all the time. We hear that the state might not have jurisdiction to intervene and provide policing support to the tribes, and that, basically the bad actors take advantage of jurisdictional loopholes. What can you tell us about that in the context of your reporting here?
Yeah. And so I guess one thing I forgot to add that might help contextualize this is that the certification, the BIA certification, is going to be required for the tribal law enforcement officers going through the training right now. It'll be optional for the other recruits, and that might be something that would be very helpful for officers who are in counties that are located next to reservations. But Attorney General Jackley says, you know, as a former U.S. attorney and a state's attorney for a couple of rural West River counties, and as the current attorney general in has been a former attorney general, that when the need arises, where those jurisdictional issues may occur, you know, if law enforcement needs to respond to something in the field, they can respond to it.
Mm-hmm. Law enforcement in the field doesn't have jurisdictional boundaries. When there is a need for public safety, the officers in the field address it and take care of it.
Jackley says those jurisdictional issues, they can be resolved later in the courts. But that being said, you know, Governor Noem wants to work towards getting memorandums of understanding in place between the state and tribes that would allow both to work together to address law enforcement issues. And that was something that was brought up during the Tribal Public Safety Crisis Summit last month, but none of them were signed as of yet.
All right. SDPB's Lee Stribinger, thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's pivot now and talk about the historic rainfall and flooding from the end of June that has left so many South Dakotans wondering what comes next. Questions and confusion lingers surrounding FEMA assistance, donations, and the general status of flooded areas. County emergency management teams are helping residents navigate those questions. So we have Jason Westcott with us. He is the Union County Emergency Management Director, and he's joining us on the phone. Jason Westcott, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what stage of or phase of emergency management we're in right now. When you look at a plan, what part of the plan are we in?
Well, so normally it starts with the disaster phase, and the disaster phase is really fast. Whatever disaster happens, occurs, and it hits pretty fast. And we move into what's called our recovery stage. And that's kind of what we're in with the flooding right now, as we're trying to get into recovery stage and get everybody kind of back to where we need to be in some normalcy.
You are getting a ton of phone calls and emails and questions. What are some themes that are emerging from a flood-impacted residents that they want to know?
Well, one of the big things is the question of when is FEMA going to show up, and when is FEMA going to be on the ground and start looking at my residents and make some decisions? I can tell people FEMA will be in our area in Union County the week of July 15. At that time is when they will start doing damage assessments. In order for them to look at your residents, though, before they do a damage assessment, we need people to report on the state porthole for damage. The easiest way to find that currently is go to unioncountysd.org, and straight on the Union County webpage is a flooding section in the middle of the page. That self-reporting link is about in the middle of the page, and that helps FEMA out tremendously in finding out who has damages and where they need to go and look for those damages.
You said unioncountysd.org. Did I hear you right?
Correct.
Okay, so you're going to start with the state portal. Is that holding up to the number of requests that you're having, or do people need to prepare to be a little patient as they try to access the website?
That portal can process quite a few people in a day, so we haven't seen any overloading yet.
Do you have a sense of what kind of information you should be gathering if you have damage and you want to, you know, before you log in and start the reporting process, what kinds of information should you have at your fingertips?
So it's a pretty simple form. It kind of guides you through. It's going to ask your address. You enter that, it asks your name, and it's going to tell you at that point what the value of your residence is. So that kind of gives you a basis when it starts asking, you know, how much damage do you think you have? We always tell people take a lot of photos. Those can be attached to that report. And then basically all you got to do is tell that system what kind of damage you had. There's sections where you can actually go in and type paragraphs and tell them, you know, hey, my water heater is dead, or I lost this much sheetrock, or I lost this item. So all that can be put into that report. And that is the big first step for FEMA and getting here and making sure that they know that your residence is damaged. Lots of people think FEMA, you know, is going to go door to door, knock, you know, try to get you at your house and you're not home because your house is flooded. Lots of time, what FEMA will do is what they call windshield assessments. They will just drive to these areas, look at the homes, and know that they're damaged and log that house is damaged and moved on. They don't even need to look at the interior because they can see from the outside the damage. Sometimes they do have homes that are a little bit questionable on the fringe of, you know, are these damaged? Is this flood related? And those are the ones that, you know, they may call you and say, hey, we want to stop by your residence and take a peek and see what's going on.
If you don't have access to the internet, perhaps you lost your services and it's very difficult for you to access. Are there ways to figure out about FEMA assistance that are beyond logging on?
Yes. Currently down at the North Sioux City Library, when the library is open, we do have a volunteer down there that has an internet system set up on one of their computers. And if you don't understand the internet or have an issue, you know, getting through those forms or need some guidance, she is there and she will be able to help you get through those forms and get you entered into the system.
All right. A lot has been made over what happens next for future disasters. In your estimation, in your role, I don't ask you to step outside of that, when is the moment to start thinking about what needs to be changed in the future? Is it now as you document things, or is it down the road?
Well, and that's kind of a hard question to answer. And there's been a lot of talk about of, you know, do I rebuild my home? Do I not rebuild my home? Do I fix what's damaged? And, you know, that's a hard question to answer until we can get some answers made out of FEMA. You know, they're the ones that are going to have to decide, you know, with like the city of North Sioux, are we going to make this a mitigation area? Are we not going to make this a mitigation area? Are we going to come up with a plan that, you know, maybe the next time instead of routing the water this way, we're going to route it that way? And that's all stuff that probably will occur down the road. It's not going to be something instantaneous. I know a lot of people are looking for that instant answer and, you know, let's make some decisions right now. And FEMA, I wish, moved faster on that type of thing, but they don't.
Yeah.
So I do know, you know, the city's looking at some options, the county's looking at options, and those are going to be talks that will have to happen down the road after we get the current situation taken care of.
We'll leave it there for now, but we'll put all the links up to information for people on our website as well at sdpb.org. Jason Westcott, thank you for showing up for the radio audience, many of whom don't have internet, so we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There is a classic Calvin and Hobbes comic strip where the teacher, Miss Wormwood, asks Calvin, who as a general rule finds school painful and absurd, to lead the class in the Pledge of Allegiance. Calvin has a panic attack. He can't recall what the U.S. Supreme Court has said about the pledge. Is it a form of prayer? Does the teacher have to read him his rights? What court district is he in? He doesn't want to be a political test case. He's just a kid. For Teacher Talk, we have been exploring landmark education decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court and asking what they mean for teachers in the profession today. So let's discuss the Pledge of Allegiance when it was partnered with an official school prayer. Gina Benz has received the Milken Educator Award. She has taught for more than 23 years. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota and director of the Student for Center and Professional Services in the School of Education. Here is Gina Benz setting up today's Teacher Talk case.
Engel versus Vittel. This happened in Long Island, New York, 1962, and it really happened pretty quickly, actually. Sometimes these court cases take, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. This was a quicker one, and it has to do with school prayer, that hot button issue, which we're starting to see more issues recently in the news with regard to religion and the school system. But let me give you a little history. Stephen Engel, he's a Jewish man, and it was in Hyde Park, which is, again, Long Island. He and other parents sued the school board president, who is the Vittel in the name of the case, in order to strike down a new New York state law that required schools to have all students recite the Pledge of Allegiance and a pretty short 20-word voluntary non-denominational prayer at the start of the school day. And there were some school districts in the state of New York that didn't do that. Mm-hmm. They didn't follow the law. They were nervous about, well, exactly what happened. It went to court. The lower courts said, nope, this is okay because it's voluntary prayer and it's non-denominational. But the Supreme Court had a different opinion. They said that in a school setting, is it really voluntary? You know, mm-hmm. you have a captive audience. And then secondly, they said that, you know, the school, or you could even say the state, was choosing a prayer, which really didn't apply to all religions. And so then it was the school establishing a certain religion as its preference, and that goes against the Establishment Clause in the Constitution.
Yeah. Any further context to that, Jackie, that people need to understand, that teachers need to understand exactly of the story of the case that you wanted to tease out to make sure before we move on to maybe the impact of the decision?
Sure. I think that the only thing I want to add, and now that you said impact at the end of that, I think I might be headed that way. I think the thesis that most teachers need to realize is that the school itself cannot promote a religion, but that doesn't mean religion can't be taught in schools or discussed.
Religion is not banned. Mm-hmm. Students can pray.
Right.
Yes, you know, and students would have to excuse themselves, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that creates a certain amount of attention and spectacle that is uncomfortable yeah. for all people, and especially children.
All right. So these are things that still spark a lot of debate, as you say in your companion blog, specifically In God We Trust, which is a new South Dakota law from 2019 that has to be displayed, mandatory display of this. And we all had this debate a whole bunch of times over the past few years. And you point out in this another ruling from 2022 that was pretty well known about a football coach. Tell us a little bit about that. Not from South Dakota. Tell us a little bit about that ruling and how it weaves into this.
I can briefly start with the South Dakota one and just say that in every public school, there must be a sign near the entrance or in a very public spot that says, In God We Trust. And so I challenge people, go into your schools and look for that sign. Mm-hmm. In my school, it's right by the front doors. And I think my school district has done a very tasteful job of incorporating that. And there's some education that's involved on that poster. And why is this not making its way through the courts? I think one explanation I can figure out is because In God We Trust is our national motto. It's on our money. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one reason why this one isn't getting challenged. However, some will say, you know, just using the word God promotes certain religions over others.
Right. So a key aspect of this, Jackie, was a lot of school districts were nervous about the South Dakota In God We Trust law because they were afraid that a student or a parent would sue. This gets into, again, we're reminding listeners that none of us are attorneys or lawyers or law professors, but there was a lot of concern. And part of the way that they negotiated the legislation was to ensure that school districts would not go broke defending a state law. So the state of South Dakota will pay for the legal defense should a family or a student sue over this legislation. So I want to talk about a couple things here. One, the idea that students are a captive audience. Jackie, what does that bring up for you? Because the In God We Trust legislation was like, yeah, we want people to see this. So it has to be in a place where they're likely going to see it, the front door, the cafeteria. It can't be stuffed in the principal's office, for example. So talk a little bit about creating an environment where you are ensuring that students come in and see the things that you want them to see, and you're creating a space that tells them what's important in this school. What does that bring up for you?
Oh, my gosh, so many things, Lori. Mm-hmm. Wow. I think a few things here. One is that in the case that we're discussing, or the idea that a school could be sued, or that there are ways that we resolve these types of issues in our American system. Mm-hmm. And so I think the anxiety that comes up for people is actually the system doing what it's designed to do, which is help us resolve these issues that we are struggling with. What are we trying to promote in schools? What are our values in the American education system? What do we want to have displayed in the schools? Who gets to decide that? All of these things that are part of the conversation that does lead to anxiety for folks, because it can be sticky, it can be dicey. These are our friends, these are our neighbors. Mm-hmm. We don't always agree on everything, but yet our kids go to school together. Our teacher lives down the street. We have to resolve these things, and the American system is designed through this legal apparatus to be able to come to some of these conclusions. So that's one thing I've been working on in my own way of going, is to not have too much anxiety about the fact that this is the way things could possibly go. There could be a lawsuit, but rather to embrace the fact that we do have a system to help us parse out how we're going to operate with these types of questions.
Yeah, really well said. Let's talk about Kennedy v. Bremerton, which is the football coach who is kneeling in prayer at the 50-yard line after football games. Some students are joining with him. Other students are joining, but they say they don't want to, but they're afraid they're not going to get playing time unless they pray with the coach. And I wanted to ask you, this brings up something about Supreme Court, by the way, upheld his right to kneel in prayer at the 50-yard line, which was a reversing of some precedent from years before. It was a fairly newsworthy case at the time. But again, since we're not legal scholars, I really want to ask you as teachers how you bring your own faith or your own not faith to the classroom. By that I mean, how do you bring your own self to the mm-hmm. classroom when you know the self that you're bringing might be something that certain students have a completely different way of seeing the world? It doesn't have to be about religion. I'm not asking you to reveal things to listeners, but how do you bring yourself and yet respect the selves of all these little selves that come mm-hmm. walking in to see you every day? Jackie, would you start with that one, please?
Oh, yeah. I think that's something that everyone has to figure out for their own selves. And I think I'm still in continuous conversation with myself about what is my public-facing self and what is my private-facing self. What do I share with my students, with folks on this program? You know, what do I bring to let them in? Because I'm not a robot. I don't want to be one. I don't want to have robots teach our kids. I want people teaching our kids. And so people are complicated, and they have all kinds of personal quirks. So I think remembering the role that you play is incredibly important. You are a person who is a role model when you're a teacher. You are a person that is to be trusted when you are a teacher. You are a person who has academic knowledge to impart on people. And I think keeping those kind of tenets in mind, or having a remembrance of the role that you're in helps you to parse out those day-to-day decisions you have to make about what to share and when. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side of that, it is incredibly important to affirm the students in front of you and to remind them that part of going to school is to develop as a full human being. It sure it's to learn math and sure it's to learn to read, but it is also to develop a sense of oneself. And you can't do that if you're not allowing yourself to figure out who you are in a broader sense. Mm-hmm. So affirming students for who they are is an incredibly important part of the process.
Yeah. Gina, talk about authority. Having the authority that you need to manage a classroom and create a safe learning environment for people, which we'll talk about in our next conversation, really focusing on what does that mean to have a safe and focused environment. But just presenting yourself in front of the classroom when you are a whole and complete human being and making sure that you understand how a student might see your authority and feel coerced to reflect to you that they agree with you about something that maybe they don't really agree with. Or
that's a very big issue for me, especially as an English teacher, because students write things and they mm-hmm. know I'm going to read them and have to put a grade on them. Mm-hmm. And students will think about their audience, as they should, and sometimes feel inhibited in that they can't write about certain things based on who they know I am or think I am. And so I take that goal of being a neutral type of person very seriously, so that students can write about and explore whatever their values and beliefs are. In with that is that idea is I need my classroom to be a safe space for students to explore, to learn. And sometimes they're going to go in directions that years later they might regret that they went in their writing or discussions. But the classroom to me is a laboratory where we try things out, and mm-hmm. it has to be a safe place for that. And so I can't let students be nervous that I have very strong beliefs and then their grade will be impacted because right. they've gone against my beliefs.
Yeah. How many of us have written something in college or high mm-hmm. school or middle school that we look back on and cringe a little mm-hmm. bit with?
Oh, of course. I think that's important, though. Yeah. Like, if we were all the same people that we were when we were 12 or mm-hmm. 15 or 28, you know, it's still, we evolve.
Yeah. For young teachers who are studying education and are going to go into a classroom, if I want to be a teacher, can I bring my faith into the classroom? Let's say my faith is important to me. It's a grounding factor in my life. I don't want to leave it behind. What are the ways that you would say, Jackie, that someone can bring their faith into a classroom in a way that is supportive of everyone in that room?
I think I see teachers do this well regularly. I think that there are ways to talk about who you are and what you believe that doesn't go against this case that we're talking about, which is saying the school itself is promoting this, or mm-hmm. I, as this teacher, am promoting this in this classroom. Just the same way that people talk about cheering for a certain basketball team, or you know what I mean? Like, there are parts of ourselves where if you say, oh, I root for the Chicago Bulls, and all of your classroom is not Bulls fans, it doesn't mean that everyone's going to fail all of a sudden, right? Yeah. In the same way, if you declare your religion or say what your perspective is in any number of quote-unquote hot-button issues, that doesn't mean that you are then telling the students what to think or who to believe. In fact, it's saying, I'm a person who has beliefs, and I'm able to see that you have beliefs yourself that I also value. And I really appreciate this about our education system, particularly in classrooms where there are a lot of different beliefs, a lot of different types of people. We're able to then say, I know that person, I care about that person, and now because I've met them and they have beliefs that are different than mine, I can see that culture, that worldview, that way of going that I maybe wouldn't have encountered before had I not sat next to this person in class or had that person as a student.
Yeah. Gina, sometimes it seems like it would be easier to just, we're not talking about religion, but in literature, it often comes up. You're reading The Scarlet Letter, for example. how do you handle, and what's the benefit of using literature to bring up conversations about how people act their faith and the challenges of that that will help students think deeply about their own beliefs and how they want to represent them in the world. What's the role of a good book in all that?
The role of a good book is also the role of a good teacher. Good teachers ask good questions, and good books bring up good questions that help us examine ourselves, our role in the world, our purpose in the world. And so I go about it by just asking the right questions, not leading questions that lead toward a certain belief, but the right questions that get students thinking deeply. And then I provide a safe atmosphere where students can talk with each other first in small groups and share what their thinking is and not be intimidated or scared by how other students might respond. I emphasize again and again and again that we can listen to one another's beliefs and opinions. We don't have to agree with them, but we're going to listen. And ultimately, you can only defend or talk about your own belief really well if you've heard the other side or other sides. Many times there's more than one other side. So you have to create a classroom where people feel safe to talk and even honored when they have the courage to share.
Is that getting harder in a American society that becomes more polarized? Is it getting harder to even talk about the Great Gatsby in ways that some of our deep divisions don't show up?
Well, it could be harder. You just have to do a lot of work on the front end. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, teachers, you have to explicitly say what we're doing in this room. We're not promoting a certain belief. We're just having a discussion. We're listening to each other. Sometimes you will play the devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. Notice sometimes your classmates will play the devil's advocate. We're just going to have some civil discourse. And that's important.
Yeah. Jackie, add one more thing to that.
I think acknowledging that it's hard and that we're going to make mistakes and have to apologize is a really important ground rule. I had to apologize often and still have to apologize often because I didn't realize how I said something or how it came across or how it made someone else feel. And even if my intentions, which I would like to think they were always the best of intentions, doesn't mean that that's what the outcome was. You know, and that happens for so many of us. And so I think that that's a real fear that students have. I think that's a fear that teachers have and soon-to-be teachers have, is that they're going to mess up. They're going to say the wrong thing. And I would say, yes, you are. That's part of it, right? And that acknowledgement of the fact that we're human, we're having these human conversations, the mistakes are inherent. We are flawed as a species. And so to embrace that and to focus more on the repair of the relationships as those tricky conversations can unfold. And I also want to say that it's not like we spend all day, every day having these tricky conversations, right? Like a lot of days we are straightforward, talking about the curriculum, talking about, you know, these like learned things. But part of going to school is that the world happens, and so you do have to. Kids have questions about the world and what's happening. And so the role of the teacher is also to help them navigate those things.
Yeah. You can find companion blogs for Teacher Talk online, sdpb.org/teachertalk. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In 1998, Fugees vocalist Lauryn Hill released a solo album. Maybe you remember it. Maybe you haven't thought about the miseducation of Lauryn Hill for a while. That's what lists are for. You know the ones? Top albums of all time. For today's Fresh Tracks, David Hirschrud takes a listen to the selections from Apple Music and asks himself what's been memorable about 2024 at the halfway mark.
Lauryn Hill. Lauryn Hill. Lauryn Hill.
Most people probably don't pay attention to the listing of the best albums of all time. Publications and social media put them out in some cases on a fairly regular basis. In fact, I would doubt that anyone could remember the top 10, 15 minutes after reading the list. However, Apple Music just put out a list of the top 100 albums, and it caught my eye because the number one album was The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill.
It's funny how money changes situation. miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation, don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauren like she done. But remember not to game new under the sun. Everything you did has already been done. I know all the tricks from...
Came out in 1998, a neo-soul R&B album that is considered a classic. In fact, it's included in Pace Magazine's Top 30, and Rolling Stone put it in their Top 10. So it got me thinking, because we're about the middle of the year, and I started thinking about my list of the Top 10 albums of 2024 so far. 7 of my Top 10 were female artists. There was St. Vincent, Brittany Howard, Kali Uchis. Now, just in case anybody's wondering, Pace Magazine's top album is Stevie Wonder's Song in the Key of Life. And Rolling Stone's top album is Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Getting back to 2024, as I was thinking about some of the best albums that I've heard and some that we haven't talked about on the program, there were 3 additional albums by female artists that I think people need to hear.
Let's start with a Pakistani-American singer and composer. Tell me about her.
Her name is Arush Aftab. And this is her 4th album. Last year, she won the Best Global Music Performance at the Grammys. Her 2021 album, Vulture Prince, made all kinds of year-end's best-of lists. She's a world artist, but her music transcends jazz, pop, classical, Hindustani, fusion. In fact, she's almost impossible to pigeonhole. One of the best songs on the album, there's a classic called Autumn Leaves, which if you pull it up on Google will tell you that it is the 11th most recorded jazz standard of all times. She makes it sound like you're hearing the song for the first time.
The falling.
To Iceland once again.
Her name is Leve.
Don't you notice how I get quiet when there's no one else around? Me and you and awkward silence. Don't you dare look at me that
and
way.
And she's got, she had an album come out last year called Bewitched, which made a lot of best of lists. She came out this year with what she called the Goddess Edition. She took the album and added 4 new songs to it. I mean, really, really impressive. She is from Iceland, a singer-songwriter. Started out as a cello soloist with the Icelandic Symphony Orchestra at the age of 15. And after that decided to accept to the Berklee College of Music. She went there and switched from cello to vocals. She puts out what I would call jazz-inspired pop music. All of a sudden, there's a lot of interest in a lot of standard jazz artists, the Billie Holidays, the Ella Fitzgeralds, all that kind of thing, which I think is absolutely wonderful. Again, Leve, remember that name.
All right, next up, China Forbes. We know China Forbes because of Pink Martini, and many of our listeners know Pink Martini because Ari Shapiro of NPR sometimes sits in with Pink Martini, but China Forbes is the frontliner. Tell me about her album.
Well, I get to tell you, I am a huge fan of Pink Martini, have seen them a number of times. I think the latest was a couple of years ago when they played Red Rocks in Denver. Mm-hmm. And I mean, talk about a fun evening. I'd go just about anywhere to hear them. They call themselves the Little Orchestra that plays classical, Latin, pop, and jazz. And China is the lead singer, and she's been a co-writer for many of the band's songs on their 7 albums. She hasn't done a lot of solo albums. In fact, her last solo album came out 17 years ago. She has a new solo album out, and I have to tell you, it's spectacular.
Suddenly you're back where you started again. We come full circle, we go round robin. We go up, we burn out, we come down.
Back to this idea of a best albums of all time list. One of the benefits of that is it resonates when someone says, hey, this is one of the best of all time, and you've heard it. There's a familiarity to those lists that send you back to listening to your favorite album again and again. Do you think that these albums that you've surfaced for us today are going to be the kinds of albums that 10 years from now, 25 years from now, we look back on and say, that one rises to the top? What makes an album that rises to the top?
That is kind of an interesting way to put it, because in most cases, the decisions that are made as they put these lists together are done by music critics, in some cases, people who are involved in the music industry. So you never really, really, really know. My guess is, I think a Rouge Aftab, I think that something that she's going to do, if not this album, is going to make some top lists. I know all three of these albums are going to be a lot on the best lists of 2024. There's some stuff on the best of lists, whether it's coming from Pace Magazine, Rolling Stone, Apple, or Amazon, that you're probably going to question. But I think one of the wonderful things about going through those is, you know, going, patting yourself on the back and saying, you know, I have that album in my collection. I'm gonna go put it on and listen to it.
You just lost one. What's a bomb bomb?
Hi, people. I'm gonna write something on the board. Let's spell it. First letter.
L. O.
What's that?
Love.
What?
Let's do a local love song now. Eliza Blue returns to In the Moment on Thursday to talk about her new book, Little Pasture on the Prairie. Let's close the hour with Every Song's a Love Song Now. It's the final number of The Grass Widow. That's a folk opera written by Eliza Blue with John Bakken. And it's a love song, but it's not about the love between two people. It's about the love a woman has for the prairie. Take a listen.
Waiting
lost my sea of disbelief. And I'll admit that I was lost. And then I'd wandered for too long. And then found you in the fields. And then I found you in the barn. Hay still green and sweet, in the dust and in the dirt, in the first full blush of spring. Every song's a love song now. Every song I sing's for you.
Eliza Blue is with us in the studio on Thursday. Looking forward to that. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, Governor Kristi Noem's official social media accounts have undergone a significant change, and the governor has received significant criticism for her response to recent flooding in the state. The Dakota Political Junkies offer their analysis. Plus, how do we relearn to coexist with water, especially water moving where we don't want it to go? Tim Kalman is with us for a map of the recent flooding. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.